This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Burn out!
That's Walton Goggins playing a white supremacist, shouting fire in the hole as he blows up a black church with a rocket launcher. It's a scene from the first episode of the FX series Justified, which was based on a story by Elmore Leonard. In the first season of Justified, Goggins' character Boyd Crowder did time in prison, where he was born again and dedicated himself to Jesus. The second season premieres February 9th. Terry spoke with Walter Goggins last year about his role in Justified and about another memorable performance in The Shield as Detective Shane Vendrell, a member of a corrupt narcotics strike team. Let's hear another clip from Justified. The show is centered around a deputy U.S. Marshal, Raylan Givens, played by Timothy Oliphant. He's been sent back to his hometown in Kentucky, where his old friend Boyd Crowder, played by Goggins, is being investigated for robbing a bank. Boyd and Raylan used to work together in the coal mines as teenagers. Now they're on opposite sides of the law. In this scene, before Boyd's religious conversion, Boyd and Raylan are meeting again after many years and have been talking about the time they spent together in the mines. Boyd, the white supremacist, speaks first.
Yeah, all those days, good and bad, they all long gone now. Everything's changed.
It's all changed.
Mine has changed. No more falling a seam underground. Cheaper to take the tops off mountains and let the slag run down and ruin the creeks. Hey, you remember the picket lines, don't you? Of course, back into company scabs and gun thugs.
Whose side do you think the government's always been on, Raylan? Us or people with money?
And who do you think controls that money? Who do you think wants to mongrelize the world?
Who?
The Jews.
What? You know any Jews?
See, I recruit skins. They don't know no more than you do. And I have to teach them that we have a moral obligation to get rid of the Jews. See, it was in the Bible.
Where?
In the beginning. It's part of creation. See, in the beginning, right, you had your mud people. Now, they were also referred to as beasts because they had no souls. See, they were soulless. And then Cain, now you remember Cain now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cain, he laid down with the mud people. And out of these fornications came the Edomites. Now, do you know who the Edomites are?
Who?
They're the Jews, Raylan.
You're serious?
Read your Bible as interpreted by experts.
Oh, you know, boy, I think you just use the Bible to do whatever the hell you like.
Well, what do you think I like, Raylan?
You like to get money and blow shit up.
That's a scene from the FX series Justified. Walton Goggins, welcome to Fresh Air. You may be a white supremacist in Justified, but I love watching you. It is so much fun to watch you in this series. Did you feel like you had to figure out why some people become white supremacists before you could play one?
On some level, but I never believed that Boyd Crowder was a white supremacist, to be quite honest with you. In my conversations with both the network and with Graham Yost, our executive producer, and Tim Oliphant, it was very important for me as an actor not to play this guy as a white supremacist, but to play him as a bit of a Svengali, a person who doesn't necessarily believe all that he espouses. You know, I've made 4 Southern movies. I've been in quite a few Southern films. And initially, when this was sent to me, I wasn't interested in playing another Southern guy labeled as a racist. You know, I think racism is a problem throughout our country, and it's not confined to those states below the Mason-Dixon line. And for me, I did not want to perpetuate a stereotype. So I had them take out references to our president, Barack Obama, and I wouldn't say the N-word. And I said I would do this if Raylan was able to point out that Boyd doesn't necessarily believe that which he is saying. And that was very important to me. The other thing that I wanted to explore with Boyd, which I think is more appropriate for him as a person, kind of getting in his skin, was to explore his intellect. And I don't think that that was there in the original pilot. It was tweaked very easily, with a couple of different sentences here and there that explored how smart this guy really was. That was important to me, more so than that was interesting to me. Just to be a racist didn't interest me.
So, okay, so going along with the premise that your character's a really smart man who is in a bad situation and has become a white supremacist, not because he deeply believes that everything is the Jews' fault and black people's fault, but because that's the way to get power in the area that he is, with the people that he knows. He goes to prison, and in prison he undergoes a religious conversion and is born again and dedicates his life to Jesus. So he says, I have no idea watching the series whether you're serious about Jesus and having been converted or not, and I'm wondering if you know.
I do know. I think it was a discovery, you know, along the way. I don't think I knew initially. I don't think that Graham or the other writers on the show knew initially, and I thought it best that we, as did they, that we keep it ambiguous until we figure it out. I think that I figured it out shortly thereafter.
He's organizing a church now made up of meth dealers and survivalists. And
absolutely. Black and white, by the way. Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
That's part of his revelation.
He's a walking paradox for sure.
So you grew up in the South. You were born in Birmingham and grew up in Georgia. The accent that you use in the show, is that an accent that you're familiar with? Because it's supposed to be a Kentucky accent.
It is supposed to be a Kentucky accent. I don't know quite how accurate it is. I did study a little bit about people from Kentucky and kind of how they talk. It's not an accent that I'm familiar with. It's different because the cadence is so specific to Elmore Leonard, and it's slightly stilted and heightened in
mm-hmm,
a way
mm-hmm.
That I also think reflects, for me, what I'm trying to do, whether it comes across or not, but something that speaks to Boyd's intelligence. You know, more often than not, I don't or haven't seen Southern characters like this, with a penchant and a love for words. And we were able to, in the pilot episode, kind of introduce that. And he says, innocuous. I was sitting there right before we were going on and talking over this scene with Graham, and said, you know, what if he were to say, just kind of offhandedly, because it's the way his mind works, he were to say, you picked an innocuous target. You know what that means? That means harmless. So he not only uses these words, but he also gives the definition right afterwards, as if he's very proud of knowing how to use a certain word.
And that he also assumes the people who he knows won't know the word.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the people that he hangs out with won't know the answer to the definition of those words.
So the first episode of Justified is based on an Elmore Leonard short story called Fire in the Hole.
It is.
And I'll confess, I haven't read that story. So I was wondering, does your character in that story have the religious conversion, or does that story end before the arc?
That story ends with the death of Boyd Crowder. And I have not read that short story either, and purposely did not read it after getting the job, because I didn't want to be influenced by it.
Mm-hmm.
But as I understand it, he dies at the end of the pilot, which is exactly how we filmed it. I was only to do one episode. Boyd Crowder actually does get shot in the heart. It is only after showing it to audiences that Boyd Crowder lived. About 3 months later, right when the show was getting picked up, I came on to do more episodes, and we reshot the ending so that Boyd had an opportunity to live.
Oh, resurrected.
Yeah, absolutely. He's like Jesus. He is Jesus. He came back in 3 months.
Can you, like, deconstruct the voice that you do a little bit for us? Like, give an illustration of how you put it together?
Well, this is a person with probably a ninth grade education. I think he's extremely well read. I don't think that he feels the need to raise his voice in certain ways. I think he understands the power of manipulation sometimes can lie in whispering to people and getting close to people and not averting one's gaze, but looking deep into their eyes and talking to their very soul.
Right, good.
How did that come off?
Very well.
Good. So do I have you on my team, Terry?
I don't think
do
so.
Do I have you?
No. Not on Boyd's team. No, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, I understand.
So what was it like to have a swastika tattoo and, you know, spout all that Christian identity, religion stuff? I mean, that there's the Christian identity movement that believes Jews are the mud people.
Yeah, it was, you know, honestly, it was awful. It really was. A lot of my friends at FX are, one gentleman in particular, Eric Schreier, is Jewish, and we did a table reading of this script, and I had to say that monologue, and immediately after felt like I had to say, I'm sorry, I don't believe any of this, everyone in the room, I have, my best friends are Jewish. It's difficult, and it's difficult to have a swastika on your arm, you know, and I actually wore it home. I didn't let him take it off, so I kept it with me during the process of filming the pilot episode, and there were
wait, you
a
wanted
of
to
times,
be infected by it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you're certainly infected or affected by ink on your body, and something as powerful, a symbol as powerful as a swastika. I definitely wanted to kind of feel that. And there were times during the day when I wasn't working and I was out at dinner that I would roll up my T-shirt and I would leave the swastika there just to see people's reaction. And there was one time when I was with Tim and I had rolled my shirt up just to see what would happen. And Tim didn't notice it for about 5 minutes until there were tourists walking through the lobby of the hotel who almost gasped. You could hear them step back with their Starbucks coffee in their hand. And Tim said, please, please roll down your shirt, please, or I'm going to have to leave you here alone.
Well, yeah, I can understand his sentiment. I mean, like sporting a swastika in public is a very vile act. It's a very,
very
provocative act.
It is.
Well, I mean, what kind of reaction were you expecting?
I knew that I would get that reaction. I just wanted to see. I just wanted to see what that would be like.
It's funny, nobody noticed that you're both like actors, that you're both stars.
not for a minute, but I definitely explained afterwards that it was fake, it wasn't real.
Mm-hmm. Walton Goggins, who stars as Boyd Crowder, a white supremacist turned born again Christian in the FX series Justified, which starts its second season on February 9th. Here's a clip from the first season. Boyd's attending the church he used to go to as a child, and at the reverend's invitation, he steps up to testify before the congregation.
Well, as many of you good people may remember, I was a hateful man. I was a sinful man. Seeking my way through the darkness, looking for salvation in worldly things and evil things. Like Saul, on the road to Damascus, I was long gone on a sinful journey when the light of the Lord shone upon me on my deathbed in a prison hospital. And brothers and sisters, I'm here to tell you today that bullet missed my heart, but it struck my soul. It struck it. For I was blinded. I was blinded. I could no longer see ungodly truth. For if any man be born again in Christ, is a new creature. Well, I am a new creature.
Thank you, Boyd. Thank you, Boyd.
Not quite finished yet, Reverend.
Let me ask you about the shield and your character on it, Shane Vendrell. And you were one of the members of this really corrupt strike team. It was a narcotics team that worked the streets of L.A. and was supposed to be busting, you know, drug gangs. But it was... They were pretty dirty, so that they always took drugs and money. And
to say that they were immoral would not be an understatement. Yes.
Yes. And your character, Shane, he often thinks he's smart and that he can really come up with these schemes and even be smarter than Vic, who's the leader of the team. But he's sometimes just, like, really stupid and impulsive and does the wrong thing. And I thought we could play a scene here. And season one ends with all the members of this small strike team standing around like a dumpster of money that they've managed to steal from an Armenian gang that trafficked in prostitutes and drugs and other things. So they're standing around this like dumpster of money, and they have to figure out where are they going to put it? What are they going to do with it? And then when the next season picks up, this is a scene in which Michael Chiklis, as Vic, the leader of the strike team, is coming to see you because he needs some of the money. Here's the scene.
Hey, what's up?
I need to make an emergency withdrawal from the retirement fund. You got the key, right?
Vic, there's nothing in there.
You gotta be joking me.
No, we took it. Malem and Ronnie, we took it to invest.
Without telling me?
You put me in charge while you were taking time off.
A quarter of that stash is mine.
And I'm in the process of tripling it for you. It was gonna be a surprise.
It is. A bad one.
Like, I've been giving this thing a lot of thought.
Yeah? And what's your plan, exactly?
I've been stepping up shipments. I've been overseeing distribution.
Distribution? We're middlemen keeping the peace, not drug dealers. What the hell are you doing?
I'm not doing anything that we weren't doing before. I'm just bumping things up a level.
Well, what level is that? Prison? All right, where's my investment now?
It's all tied up in a coke shipment.
That coke that had Tio's guy bleeding from every orifice?
We don't know that that was the coke.
I need that money.
Yeah? Well, we all do.
No, I need it now to get back my kids.
That's a scene from the FX series The Shield, which is, of course, on DVD. And Walton Goggins, who played Shane, is my guest. I want you to talk about how you see the character of Shane and how you developed him.
I think that you've given a better description than I could ever give. I think that you're exactly right in the sense that he's, you know, he arrives in the room 30 seconds too late. And is continually playing catch up, and he's not a very smart guy, and doesn't think before he acts, or doesn't think before he speaks, and is very impulsive like Shane. But when Shane stepped out and tried to do the same thing, he failed miserably. Whenever he takes a leadership position, he fails miserably. He's a tragic, tragic guy.
I love watching your face in The Shield because sometimes you're just kind of blank and clueless looking, and sometimes incredibly defensive, and sometimes really hurt. There's all these like expressions that flash across your face, your eyes.
He's just mentally processing. It's like he's just trying to understand what the person just said. He spends a lot of time just playing catch-up.
Now, I read that when you were young, you were good at competitive hog calling, and I'm not even sure what that is, having grown up in Brooklyn.
You guys didn't hog call in Brooklyn?
No.
That's not how you got your pork in Brooklyn?
We got our pork in Chinese restaurants.
I understand. I understand. You know, I was first place state champion hog caller. I'll do just a Sui. I think that's about as loud as I can get in this studio. But as I was 10 years old and saw other people doing it and walked up on stage and they had to adjust the mic for sure and just leaned up on my tiptoes and I won. I got a trophy with a big hog on top. I have it in my office.
So when you win the competitive hog calling championship, is it just like... do hogs it's have to actually respond and say, yes, but coming?
Hogs don't have to respond, Terry. Hogs don't have to respond. It's the audience that responds. The audience is sitting there responding to the hog call. And right when you're done with the Hulk call, they usher you off to the Grease Pig contest.
Which is what?
They put $20 bill on the back of a hog and they grease it up, and the person who gets the $20 bill gets the $20 bill.
Oh, wow.
I grew up in around a bunch of women, believe it or not, and my aunt was an actress in the theater, and another aunt who was a publicist for B.B. King and Phyllis Diller and Wolfman Jack. So
really?
I got to meet some of them through her, but I also grew up watching my aunt perform on stage, and I think that's where I got the initial bug. But early on, when I first began in Georgia, it was also an opportunity just to kind of exercise some of these emotions, you know, that I was having as an angst-ridden teenager, and it felt good. It really felt therapeutic.
You know,
I didn't know that I would be doing this for the rest of my life.
It's funny you said angst-ridden teenager, because Shane on The Shield, your character in The Shield, sometimes behaves like an angst-ridden teenager with Vic as his father. You know, it's like his way of obeying or
Absolutely.
Disobeying. It's kind of like what a uncomfortable teenager would do, who's not yet confident in the world, but, you know, wants to follow, but also doesn't want to go along sometimes.
Absolutely. You know, I think that that Shane, I think that's a part that kind of comes from me. He didn't have the strongest father figure in his life. In Shane's life, he didn't have a male significant figure in his life, and really looked up to Vic. Vic took that spot for Shane, and in no small way defined his moral code. I don't know that Shane would have gone down that path left to his own vices. I think it was under the tutelage of Vic Mackey that Shane went down that road.
So in the final season, Shane is really over his head. He's betrayed the cops that he works with. Vic wants to kill him. And so do the Armenians who Shane stole money from. He's hiding out with his wife. She's hurt herself. She's hurt her collarbone in a fight, I think, with drug dealers. And I want to play a scene from that part of the series. So you're both hiding out. You're just coming back to the place where you've been hiding out. And she's lying down in great pain from her injury.
Hey. I'm sorry it took so long. How is it?
It's awful.
I couldn't get us anything to eat because the cops, they spotted me. Yeah, I had to ditch the car.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. Just, I want you to take these.
What are they?
They're second oils. And they will help with the pain. Okay.
Oh my. What else do you get?
Just some street, you know, some meth and weed, but a little blow, but I had to do most of it. The stuff that they made me do last night, I was cratering. And I need to stay focused so that I can get us out of this.
You can't help us if you're high, baby.
It was just enough to even me out. Okay, I promise.
That's a scene with my guest Walton Goggins from The Shield. Did you travel with cops, understudy cops, before doing the role? And I don't think any cops would much want to be associated with the characters that you and the other leads played, because you were just so corrupt and amoral.
I did. I spent, I'd gone on a number of ride-alongs with police officers here in Los Angeles, and then spent time in my car before every season, would drive around this city and the places that we were supposed to, that kind of represented Farmington in the story. And, you know, Chiklis said something early on, and I found this to be very true. You know, The Shield is fiction. I mean, it is entertainment. We tried to make it as real as possible, but it is fiction. And Chiklis said, anyone below the rank of captain will tell you that they love the show. They absolutely love the show. Anyone above the rank of captain will publicly say that they hate the show, but privately tell you that they love it. And I found that to be the case, you know, over the years with the numbers of cops that I had met over the years. And it was, there were some strange interactions with the cops.
Well, tell us
over
about
the
one
years.
Of them.
Well, I got approached by a man with I think it was an AK-47 in Panama, of all places, who kind of stopped me when I was with my significant other and started asking me for my papers. And I said, well, wait a minute. I don't have it on me. I'm sorry. I don't understand. And he just said, I love the shield. He was Panamanian. And he scared the hell out of me, for sure. And then it happened with an immigration officer flying back into this country, where he started asking me all kinds of questions and questions about drugs and this and that, and said, I think you're lying to me. I said, man, I'm not lying to you. You can look through my bags. He said, we're going to look through your bags. That's not the only thing we're going to look through. And then I was like, please take me into a room. Do whatever you have to do. And he said, I'm just kidding with you, man. Go through. When's the next episode coming on? When's the next season start? So they would just mess with you. It was like we were in this fraternity of guys in blue. And while it worked when they came up to you, it didn't always work when I tried to get out of a parking ticket or
did,
a speeding
did
ticket.
Did you try?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely I tried.
How?
I ran a stop sign in a neighborhood, and this cop kind of came up, and he let me off the hook. So he set a bad example. He's like, hey, man, all right, just don't do this again. I know you're close to home. Don't do this again. When's the next season starting? So then I felt that, oh, there's a silent fraternity of guys that I'm a part of, and I didn't know it, but now I know it. And so the next time I got pulled over, I waited for the cop to come up to the side of the car, and I just kind of looked really cocky and just kind of laid back in my seat and said, hey there, how are you? He's like, can I see your driver's license and registration, please? I said, do you really need to see that? Come on. I mean, I'm a guy in blue. And he said, let me see your driver's license and registration, please. He came back and wrote me a ticket and said, when's the next season? Come on.
Walton Goggins speaking with Terry Gross last May. Goggins co-stars in the FX series Justified. Its second season premieres February 9th. Wanda Jackson has been called the queen of rockabilly, but let's face it, there weren't a lot of women rockers who could compete for that crown. Jackson toured with Elvis Presley in the 50s, and it was the king himself who encouraged her to try and cross over from country to rock and roll. Let's Have a Party was her only top 40 record, but she had songs on the country charts, such as In the Middle of a Heartache and Right or Wrong. At age 73, Wanda Jackson is still performing. A New York Times piece says she was all cat growls, hip swivels, and howls at a recent Brooklyn show, and she has a new album called The Party Ain't Over. It's a collaboration with producer Jack White, who plays guitar on the collection of covers recorded live with the 12-piece band. The hope is that the new CD will bring her a whole new generation of fans. Terry spoke to Wanda Jackson in 2003. She told Terry about making the transition from country music to rockabilly.
Well, I started in country music, and then in 1955, after I'd graduated from high school, the first touring that I did was with a young fella early in his career, too, and it was Elvis Presley. And I worked with Elvis off and on for a couple of years, and I could see that this new style of music that he was doing that, you know, I loved it, and it I was with him right as he was really breaking big, you know. And he's the one that encouraged me to try. He said, I think you could sing this kind of music. And being just country, you know, I said, I don't think I could ever get the feel like you do. He said, sure you can. So he encouraged me. He took me to his home and played records, and then he'd sing for me and say, if you kind of do it this way. And so, you know, I had a good teacher.
So one of the things Elvis was famous for, in addition to his singing style, was how he looked on stage. You know, he was very sexy, and he was very sexually suggestive on stage, particularly for the period. Did you pick up on that aspect as well? Did you change what you wore? Did you change what you did on stage?
Well, I had already changed my stage attire, you know. I didn't want to be in full skirts and cowboy boots and cowboy hat.
Why did you want to change the look?
I don't look good in those things. That was the main thing. I've never been able to wear a full skirt, haven't to this day. And the cowboy hats and those old clubby boots, you know, I just didn't like it. I didn't feel like that was me. Because I was a big fan of Marilyn Monroe and Elizabeth Taylor, and I wanted to look like them, you know. I used to go to all the musicals and with paper and pen, and when I'd see a dress I liked, I'd sketch it down real, you know, real fast. And so we've copied one dress off of Betty Grable and one off of Marilyn, and it's kind of funny when I look back at the old pictures and say, oh, I remember where I found that type of dress. But my mother was a professional seamstress, and she did all of my costumes for me.
Let's hear a song that you wrote that was a country hit for you. It's called Right or Wrong, and this was recorded in 1960. Did you think of this as more of a country song than a rockabilly?
Yes, I did. I wrote the song, and it was definitely, it really wasn't country, but in the 60s, country music was beginning to use the violin sections and singing groups behind us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really just in the trend of what people like Patsy Cline and were doing, and Brenda Lee and things. So that song was one of the first that lent itself to that type of an arrangement.
Well, let's hear it. This is Wanda Jackson, recorded in 1960, Right or Wrong.
Right or wrong, I'll be with you. For I believe that I belong by your side, right or wrong. Right or wrong, it's gotta be. Always you, always me. Won't you take me along to be with you, right or wrong? If it's right for me to love you, it can't be wrong for me to care. If you will say you love me, my life with you I'll share, right?
Wanda Jackson recorded in 1960 her song Right or Wrong. Now, you said before that you weren't really comfortable performing rock and roll to teenagers or rockabilly to teenagers because you were used to performing for adults and you just didn't relate to these teenagers. Did that affect your staying in country music as opposed to trying to cross over more into that teen rock and roll audience?
Yeah, probably so, Terry. If Right or Wrong, you know, right after Let's Have a Party, Right or Wrong became a hit. It was a crossover song, too, meaning it was high on the charts in country, but it was also in the rock and roll or the, I think then they called it pop and soul music. So it was in the charts, and that's when I tried to do these teenage things and just, you know, didn't really care for it at all. So, yeah, I've considered myself country really all through my career until we get to about 1985, and I was invited to Sweden to record a rockabilly album, and it was from that point on that I realized how popular I was with the new rockabilly fans, not only in Europe, all over Europe and Scandinavia, but also in America eventually.
So you found this more specialized audience who cared a lot about your records.
Mm-hmm. And that's what made it so exciting to see these young adults into this 50s rock music. Mm-hmm. And I've just been having the greatest time working with bands that they sound just like our bands used to, and they're really into the lifestyle, and they drive the classic cars, and they dress in vintage clothes.
Now, what did your father do for a living when you were growing up?
He was a barber for a while, and he drove a cab, and that he was driving a cab when he quit that to travel with me.
Because you were underage when you started performing. You weren't 18 yet, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What was it like being tutored by Elvis and how to play this kind of like sexy, rebellious music when you're traveling with your father?
Well, I don't know. I don't know as I thought of it like that. But my dad really liked Elvis. He was a big cut-up, and Elvis was too. And so they kept something going all the time, laughing and various things. And so it worked fine. Now, my dad went along to help me with driving and things like that, but he also, it was very important that my reputation stay intact. And I'm sure that was probably the main reason that he traveled with me. So I wasn't able to ever go from city to city in the car with Elvis, or I had to, you know, Dad had to drive me. I had to be in my car. And, you know, he didn't allow me to sit on someone's lap, and I couldn't lay my head on someone's shoulder if I was sleepy and they were riding with us, you know, and he was pretty strict in those things. But it did keep my reputation intact.
And there you are singing about like broken hearts and let's have a party and riot in cell block number 9.
Yeah.
With a dad making
strange.
Sure that your head isn't on anybody's shoulder. I love that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's quite a contrast, isn't it?
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I've enjoyed all of your questions.
Wanda Jackson speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. Here's a track from her new CD, The Party Ain't Over. This is Busted.
Oh, my bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, 'cause I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that won't dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county will haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted. I went to my brother to ask for a loan, 'cause I'm busted.
The British actor Jason Statham is a former Olympic diver and fashion model who made his screen debut in the 1998 thriller Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Since then, he's gone on to make such movies as The Italian Job, The Bank Job, The Transporter series, and The Expendables, becoming the biggest new action star of the last 10 years. In his new movie, The Mechanic, which co-stars Ben Foster, he plays a professional hitman. Our critic at large, John Powers, says it offers a revealing look at Statham's distinctive appeal.
A few years ago, I was interviewing a well-known Hollywood actress. At one point, she leaned across the table and said, "Did anyone ever tell you that you look just like Steve McQueen?" Well, no, actually, not even close. But even though I knew she was working me, I was secretly flattered. I mean, any guy, and especially a critic, would enjoy being compared to McQueen. You see, he embodied a very seductive male fantasy. The quiet, effortlessly virile hero who seemed to have emerged from the womb on a motorcycle. McQueen could bluff at poker, hotwire a car, and wield a gun without making a fetish of its size. Who wouldn't want to be like that? One who's clearly trying is Jason Statham, the British action star best known for B-movies like the Transporter series, who may inspire more absurd man-crushes than any other current screen actor. If you've never seen him, you could do worse than his new movie, The Mechanic. It's a brisk, highly watchable 92-minute thriller based on a 1972 movie starring another manly man, Charles Bronson. Statham plays Arthur Bishop, a crack hitman who lives in a sleek house on the Louisiana bayou. One of those artistic assassins, like George Clooney in The American, Arthur has only one friend, his mentor Harry, nicely played by Donald Sutherland. But after a big betrayal, Arthur has to kill Harry, and making matters trickier, he finds himself dealing with Harry's angry wastrel of a son, Steve. He's played by Ben Foster, a great young actor who's as explosive as Statham is stony. Steve wants to learn to be a hitman, so Arthur tries to teach this young hothead the cool art of murder. Eventually, the two find themselves bumping up against the movie's villain, a corporate type played by the prissily handsome Tony Goldwyn, who seems destined to star as Timothy Geithner in a TV movie about the Obama years. Here, Arthur phones this baddie in his high-rise lair to let him know the jig is up.
Yes.
How much was Harry's life worth?
$50 million. Harry's death was business, pure and simple.
Well, it's not going to be so simple now.
You think you can get to me before I get to you?
I already have.
Where's conference room E?
Floor upstairs, sir.
He's in the building. Get me out of here.
You're fine, Bishop.
Nothing yet.
Now, part of Statham's appeal is that he's not a Tom Cruise pretty boy or a towering monument like Clint Eastwood. He has a vivid slab of a face that holds the screen, but isn't much of an instrument for conveying emotion. As for his body, although he's pint-sized, he has the physical presence of a ripped six-footer, and he can really move. Statham spends much of The Mechanic slugging, kicking, or throttling people underwater, and we believe it. Then again, all action stars can do action. What makes the biggest ones compelling is that they provide an exaggerated look at a particular aspect of masculinity. For instance, the self-pity in Sylvester Stallone's heavy eyes, or the working-class anger in Bruce Willis's smirking contempt for authority. Statham belongs to the tradition of heroes, from John Wayne through Harrison Ford, who are laconic to the point of grumpiness. Yet it's not his terse toughness that makes him special. Oddly enough, it's his fastidiousness, a don't-touch-me fussiness that runs through nearly all his movies. In The Mechanic, Arthur not only spends his life making algebraically precise preparations for his assignments, but at home he carefully wipes his LPs, naturally he has vinyl, before queuing them up. Hooked on precision and mastery, a Statham character is never more himself than when driving 100 miles an hour, when all that matters is technique and keeping your cool. On the other hand, he's driven crazy by anyone who can't hold it together, be it the unruly Steve, who keeps making a bloody mess of Arthur's immaculately tooled schemes, or the Ukrainian Uber babe from the movie Transporter 3, who violates the sanctity of his souped-up Audi by sloshing down ecstasy with vodka. This coldly relentless focus is one reason Statham's detractors claim he seems more like a machine than a man. In fact, he's less a machine than a mechanic, which is why this new movie is perfectly titled. Statham is always obsessed with doing the job and keeping everything—tools, women, feelings in their proper place. This obsession with neatness is the true theme of The Mechanic and of Statham's persona. It's his code, his religion, his armor. So devoted to his sense of order that he'll kill for it, he incarnates a fantasy of perfect control that taps into something deep in the male psyche, even as it leaves most women rolling their eyes.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.